Welcome to Tech Life Stories, sponsored by talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. My name is Khan Azmi and I'm your host. You will find me posting daily on LinkedIn, so connect with me there for more about the crazy world of technology. I have spent the past 25 years talking to tech leaders, so we will go behind the scenes each week, taking a deep dive into interviewing tech leaders to understand their journey from when they started to where they are today. I'll be finding out more about why they got into tech, discussing their work history, some of the projects they've been part of, some of the most influential people in their career, and much more. We produce a weekly show which is available every Monday at 6 a.m, just in time to start your week in the right way. And the podcast will be available on all platforms, including Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts. If you prefer to see us visually, you can also find us on YouTube channel, Tech Life Stories. So remember, it's not what people think of you when you first start, it's what people think of you when you finish. Welcome to another episode from Tech Life Stories. I'm joined today by Charlotte Picker, currently working at Gymshark, previously worked for the likes of Metapack, Selfridges, Matches Fashion in a variety of different roles across product management, project management, head of PMO, program management. She's a self-confessed generalist across operations and technology, creative career conversationalist, Read Women in Tech mentor. She is a co-host of her own podcast, Careers and Coffee, which she does with Lucy Greenway, who we've had on the podcast recently. Certifications in Prince 2, Scrum Master, CIPD, and a degree in international business. I hope I've summed you up well. How are you? Have I covered everything well there for you, Charlotte?
I mean, that was like a good scrape of my LinkedIn, so yes.
Good. Thank good. You. Glad to hear so. I suppose it'd be good for maybe the listeners to kind of get a better feel of what is it you actually do, because it's quite you've written a generalist across operations and business operations and technology. So give us a rundown of that exactly.
So I talk about being a generalist because I have a lot of breadth of knowledge rather than depth. So I've never really been what I would call a specialist in a specific area. Mm-hmm. And actually I wrote an article about this called Hello, I'm Charlotte, I'm a generalist, which you can find on my LinkedIn, which talks about the fact that I've never really knew what I wanted to do, but I had some sort of broad goals around what I wanted to achieve. And as a generalist, it's meant that I have had such a varied career. And the thing that I really love is variety in a role. So as you mentioned, a couple of the job titles I've had, but I've done pretty much every type of role you can think of in technology except for coding, which is definitely not my forte. I was director of business operations for a scale-up business for a couple of years, which is very generalist type of role where you get involved in anything to do with people, process, technology and internal tooling, and then like business reporting. So really very varied. And that's why I talk about being a generalist, or I believe the cool kids call it a multi-potentialite these days.
So. Yeah, no, it's good. I like it. I think in society, I think sometimes we're led to believe that working in a niche way is the way forward. But obviously, you're saying the opposite effectively, right? You're saying it's good to have a variety of different skills. It's good to be a generalist. You can cover much more than that. But do you think that going forward that is the right way for a career path that someone's looking to go down?
I think it's a harder career path to go down, but there are amazing communities that exist. So you'll see that I'm a member of the generalist community led by a lady called Millie, and that brings together people similar to me who have like been a chief of staff or have been like a HR generalist, or you know, there are lots of people that don't want that. I want to be on that very linear career path, or I want to stay in this very specialised area. And I think there are more of those people, and that now we're able to kind of have a name for it and be able to say, this is me. It kind of feeds into that more skill-based hiring, mm-hmm. as opposed to like role-based hiring. And I don't believe we have a linear career path anymore. I'm a big fan of like the squiggly career, Helen and Sarah that wrote that really inspired me to really hone in and own my brand of being a generalist. I wouldn't say it's for everybody, because some people do like to become and have real strong expertise. And there's obviously still a massive place in business for specialists, but there's becoming more of a place for generalists who essentially are really great problem solvers. And that's one of my power skills, is definitely is being a creative problem solver.
Good, good. I think it'd be good to know, go back and find out how you kind of got into technology. It's, I always find it quite interesting. And especially I find when I speak to women in technology, it's quite an interesting kind of conversation to see how that, because you mentioned obviously straight away, no coding kind of background. So how did you start your career in tech?
So, I mean, I think my parents found it very funny that I ended up in what they call IT.
Yeah.
Because I never really showed that much aptitude for it at school. And so you mentioned at the beginning of the show that I did a degree in international business. Again, very general, very broad. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. But I knew, because I had always had a part-time job, be it, you know, working on the shop floor or working in a contact centre, I was very driven by having a role that had purpose and kind of customer focus. And I knew I wanted to go to university, but again, didn't know what I wanted to do. But one of the things that had become quite popular when I was at university was the rise of the sandwich degree and the year in industry or industrial placement. Yeah, I think they're all called different things now.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got into IT, because I ended up going and working for Network Rail on their industrial placement year.
Okay.
And worked in application support and did what they called call admin, and basically manually reassigned tickets to the appropriate teams, and then kind of got more exposed to, they used Oracle at the time, their Oracle e-business suite, so supported some of those kind of first, second line tickets. And then the second part of that was then going and working in the training function and basically enabling delegates to access the right technology courses. And after a year of doing that, I was offered their graduate scheme. I then actually ended up taking a different graduate scheme. But I went to go for something more operational. And then when I went to accept, they said, but we do have this IT scheme, which actually we think you'd be really good at, and we haven't really been interviewing candidates for it. So I spoke to somebody in that world, and then I ended up taking a graduate job in IT project management in a 3PL, which is not glamorous in any way, shape or form, let me tell you.
Okay. Going back a little bit then, so you was obviously doing your degree, and obviously there was a one-year placement. Did you choose then, knowing that it was Network Rail and it was going to be doing like an app support type role, or was it that was kind of what was kind of like pushed to you? How did that come about?
I mean, you go out and you apply for lots of different roles and companies, to be really honest with you, it was the best paying one.
Okay, I like it.
And secondly, they offered me the job on the spot.
Nice.
Which is, you know, still, now I think about it all these years on, it's still a huge achievement to have been offered the job on the spot. So, and I really like the people. Mm. And for me, you know, when I think about the roles I take and that the company's been to, most of the time when I'm accepting them, it's because of the people I've met and because I actually can see that fit there. So, yes, it was money, but also, you know, because I was a poor student.
My eldest is going to be going to university next year, so he's going to be going through that motion. So I'm sure he will probably be looking at salaries as one of his core criteria when deciding on placements, etc. So I fully understand where you're coming from. So obviously you got the grad scheme in tech. So what did that entail exactly?
So I went and worked for a 3PL and essentially joined their IT project management function. Mm-hmm. I've never done any IT project management. And ironically, and you'll see that I've done a lot of project management throughout my career. I can't believe I'm going to confess this now. But at university, I did in my final year a module in project management. It was the thing I did the worst in.
Oh, God.
Yet I've been told repeatedly throughout my career I have this aptitude and real strong skill for it.
Yeah.
So I have really got no, apart from doing one module in my final year, real like kind of real life understanding of what an IT project manager was supposed to do and be. And so essentially I was there for a couple of years and did a variety of different roles. So in a 3PL, so a third-party logistics business, they had two types of customers, so your primary customers and your secondary customers. So a secondary would be like somebody like Marks and Spencer's, where they warehouse and transport to the store and to a retailer, whereas a primary customer is more like a manufacturer. So Two Sisters Food Group was a company that I worked with whilst I was there, and did a mixture of things from like a full-blown PC refresh across every single distribution center, which was dirty. I carried and what you won't appreciate from this video, but I'm only 5 foot 2.
Says my wife, don't worry.
I carried desktop PCs, because obviously this is how old I am now and how far back this goes, but carrying desktop PCs up and down and around all over, and then trying to get people off the computers and to swap them out and, manage that change curve at the same time, although I didn't realize that's what I was doing, because, people are like, oh, but I've got this one particular thing that's safe in here, and, doing stuff like that and service pack upgrades, but then also going and doing some stuff with Marks and Spencer's, was one of their customers, and went and worked with them and did they had this supplier compliance piece, which was on like a business objects program, and I got to meet people from Marks and Spencer's, and that was really my first exposure to working with a retailer. Granted, I did, work for Jones Bootmaker and fit children's shoes when I was as a part-time job, and I, did some other retail work, but actually in a professional capacity. And I think that's what really kind of sparked my interest in working in and around retail, as I have done for most of my career.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Do you find, I mean, I've worked in the tech recruitment industry now for 25 years. I generally find that organisations don't give those type of kind of grad opportunities anymore at a kind of project manager level. You still get some of the larger corporates that do, but they are becoming, I suppose, thinner on the ground. So it's quite interesting to hear that you were given that opportunity and, great opportunity to kind of like work on projects for M&S, etc. Because like you say, it gave you your entry level into retail. Where did that then kind of like take you in your career? And because obviously prior to taking that year, the first year of going into Network Rail, you didn't really think of a career in tech. So did you then know that actually there was a path in technology for you?
So, and I so after my graduate scheme, I went and explored tech in a different industry, because what I'd really learned is I liked the SaaS side of things, and because I'd done one of the sort of SaaS-based projects, and went and worked in a completely different industry, and I only worked there for a year, but it was great. And actually, the person I worked for was one of the best people I think I've ever worked for. She was fantastic. But I learned a lot, and the more, and then I think I got that hunger, because SaaS at that time was quite exciting, quite new, like that's directionally people were going that way. Because when I started my career, yes, there were SaaS type products, but there's still a lot of on-premise, which was clunky and tended to be like male dominated and less attractive, I guess. And then I sort of this the software side of things just really appealed to me, and I, as I said, developed this aptitude for project management and other skills along the way. So I think, and then after that, I did that for a year. I then went back to logistics in another SaaS business, and so I think that kind of learning around that piece, I really enjoyed that.
So would you say SAS is still kind of like the forte of your like core skill sets as like
Yeah, definitely. So even now, with what I look after, my role at Gymshark, most of the systems I look after are SaaS-based products, which come with their own challenges, of
I'm
course.
sure.
Having worked on both sides of the fence of being the SaaS provider and the SaaS customer, definitely come with challenges. But yeah, I think if you look at across my background, I've spent a lot of time working with Salesforce, other CRM platforms like Microsoft Dynamics, and then ERPs, NetSuite, and also different POS platforms like Shopify, but also I've done POS platforms that have a thin client as well, like Oracle, Xstore. So kind of a real mixture of SaaS-based products. And then obviously you mentioned I was at Metapack, which is a SaaS-based product itself.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
Have you got a favorite SaaS product?
No, I'm absolutely not saying that on a podcast. I need the negotiating power. So no, I'm not declaring that, I'm afraid.
Don't worry.
Vendor management makes up a lot of the role in a lot of the roles I've done. Vendor management has been a big part of that. So no, I'm not revealing my hand, I'm afraid.
Don't worry, I won't hold you to it. So you're now into a career as a project manager. You now know, SaaS is kind of like what you enjoy, what you want to do. Do you then, at that point, do you then see yourself for the next, have you got like a career path over the next 10 to 15 years of, do you know where you want to kind of go and get to, or do you kind of go as and when the right opportunity comes up and embrace it as that comes along?
I think, I mean, in the early part of my career where it was mainly project management, I went where it was interesting. So, as I mentioned, I then went to Metapack and joined as a project manager. And I remember day two being given an at-risk customer, an at-risk project, like the whole thing was on fire. And they were, at the time, they were 80 people in a not so lovely office in London. I'm pretty sure it had a rat.
Oh, God.
And oh, I'm joking. Or am I? They didn't have project managers, so it was a really exciting time. They were told by retailers, "You need project managers. Why haven't you got project managers?" And so as somebody who's still young into that career, I was given a huge amount of responsibility to go and deliver these big projects, which I probably didn't really appreciate at the time, were super transformational for the retailers. And the e-commerce businesses that we worked with. So I then had to learn on the job again, more so like being able to guide and give best practice because I was one of the, like, I think there was three or four of us as project managers. And we didn't really, like, our leadership at the time didn't really know what project management was either. Probably shoot me for saying that if you listen to me. But, and then I was promoted to become a senior. And took on more and more complex stuff, and it became quite apparent I was good at turning around stuff that was not going so well. And yes, I'm a glutton for punishment. And then I think that was when, up to that point, I didn't really have a plan. I just wanted to, again, this is the working class background inside of me, and I wanted to make as much money as possible, be as successful as possible, and and just grow in that space. And then at that point, I think is when my career started to pivot. And I don't think I fully realised it at the time, but then started this direction into generalism, which is where I then I was doing some international work with a project, and the project sponsor that was involved, I went to Asia with him and some of his team. And then there was a role that came available in his team, and he asked me to apply for it, which was when I took the international commercial manager role. And essentially, it was like a startup within a scale-up business. So again, it gave me this whole different experience. And I provided sort of like sales enablement support. So I had direct reports that were selling new business to different countries that we'd never worked in. And then I was doing all the enablement, the sales operations and the kind of pre-sale stuff that was behind all of that. And at the same time, we'd acquired a business in America, so I got exposure to that, got to learn a new product set. Like, and that for me was like super exciting, just having this role where I was doing like sales operations one day, then the next thing I was going and presenting at, like, I remember he asked me to go and speak at an event in America. I'd never done any public speaking at this point of time. He gave me like 2 weeks' notice. He's like, "Oh yeah, sorry, it's my fiance's birthday. Would you go and speak?" And so I sat on this panel, and there was me, little old me, who I'd been in my mid-20s, British person, sat next to somebody who'd worked at Home Depot for like 40 odd years, somebody that worked at Disney who'd also had like a 20-year career, somebody from Godiva who'd also had like 30 something year career, and they're all Americans on this panel, and they're like, and of course, because I was British, they flooded the stand afterwards because they wanted to know, like, talk to me and understand what we were doing in England. So yeah,
Must be
but
quite.
that for me was when I guess that piece was when I really sort of changed and started to then think, actually, I want to own my career a bit more.
Must have been overwhelming for you though, being on a stage and panel with that amount of experience, and like you say, you're quite early on in your career, right? Yeah.
I don't remember feeling overwhelmed. I
Okay.
remember feeling really proud that I'd been asked to do this, but then listening to them give my bio by comparison to everyone else's was quite like, yeah, so they've just sent their very junior person to come and speak here. But it built my confidence loads actually. And yeah, I don't remember feeling overwhelmed. I remember enjoying the experience and
Good.
just feeling really proud that I'd done
Yeah,
it.
good. Yeah, you should be proud, 100%. I'm sure you're even more confident now at any time anyone asks you to get up and
I
speak,
hope
right?
so,
That,
yeah.
yeah, there you go then. See, so startups are interesting for me because obviously, or let's or smaller size organization, because I've also worked in smaller size organizations, and it's probably where I learned the majority of my skill sets because you get your hands dirty in so many different areas of the business
Yeah.
when you work for a smaller enterprise. So, and that's where you said you kind of really learned where you kind of pivoted your career from that
Yeah.
generalism point of view, which is quite interesting. Do you think then that has had an that role had a massive impact then for the rest of your career?
Yeah.
Do you think then? Do you think? If you had continued going down, let's say maybe the corporate path or larger organizations, you would have got to where you are today still? Or do you think it would have, it would have been a different path that you would have had to have taken?
I think it would be a completely different path, and I don't know that I'd have the same level of fulfillment. I think my partner, he's worked for larger organizations, and he's like, I don't know why you keep going and working for these small businesses, because it comes with an element of risk, right? When you go and work for a smaller business, that you wouldn't necessarily have with a corporate. Although obviously, hindsight, obviously, whilst I've been made redundant, or my roles have been made redundant twice over the past few years, bigger business is also making roles redundant. But I think I would have had a much more specific route, and I'm not sure I would have got the same amount of fulfillment. Do I think I'd have got to the same place as to where I am today? I think I'd probably be a bit of a different person, to be honest with you, because I think embracing that corporate lifestyle is a much different skill. Like, people talk about growth mindset. That's super important when you're working in scale up startup type businesses, and is less appreciated, I think, in larger businesses. And I've noticed that, because whilst the majority of the latter part of my career I've worked in smaller startup scale up type businesses, I have also worked for a couple of larger ones in that period of time. And they don't want you to think as much in terms of flexibility. They want you to follow a process, and they want more governance. And I find that quite restricting, because it restricts my creative problem-solving brain.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I've worked for large corporates and smaller. I agree with the whole restrictive piece with the larger corporates. I think every individual is kind of like suited to one or the other a little bit. I
Yeah, I
tend to
agree.
find, yeah, I was better suited to a smaller organisation where my voice could get heard and listened to, and I could have an impact. Whereas I felt when I was working for a larger corporate, that wasn't necessarily the case, even though they said it was. I don't think it
Yeah.
really was.
I think also for me, it's the variety that you get from having a role within a smaller business. I talk about variety a lot, which is like a consistent theme for me. It's one of my key motivators is in a role is having variety in it. So when I was last laid off, I was very intentional about the jobs that I was applying for or was being approached about, because I had a post-it essentially, and on there, variety was the number one thing. And you just don't get that so much in a larger organization. Your role is very much in that square box. And for some people, that really suits them, that they know and there's no fuzzy around the edges. But I like being able to go get pulled into different things and, could you just pick this up? And so, or can you take on another team that you didn't know that we'd hired you to do? So that did happen to me when I was director of business operations. I took on a second team which I had no experience in managing or any like kind of subject matter expertise within 4 weeks of joining that organization. But I learned so much from it, and it was great. And you get those kind of great exposure opportunities. I think you get less of them, or you have to have my experience in a larger corporate is you have to be the right fit or have the right voice to get those exposure opportunities. And it's much harder to, and I think it's more political to get those in a larger organization.
So, out of interest, then that type of role, the director of business operations,
Yeah.
what element of tech is still involved in that role?
So it was made up of four things, and one of the four like pillars was internal tooling. So my responsibility around this was to make sure that we had the right internal tooling in place, and then more latterly, I had to reduce the tooling costs as the business. Then obviously, I was laid off from that role, and they needed to reduce costs. But before that, I reduced the tooling bill by about 20%. And that was doing a lot of vendor management. But also, I set up internal IT from scratch, zero to one, which was super exciting. Never done that before. Brought in an IT support manager, looked at putting in policy, some processes around, people, new starters and laptops. And then also looking at things like cybersecurity, which is not something I've ever really delved into. And growing that out and then working with managed service providers and implementing those, and then being a sponsor for any kind of tech implementation. So one of my teams, for example, implemented Zendesk, and which so I led the kind of the RFP part of it and then sponsored her to be able to deliver that. So that was kind of the tech side of that role, but it was a tech business. So I talk about having worked in tech, but I've also worked for technology businesses doing something that's less tech based in my role, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes complete sense. And then have you, from that role, have you had the same type of roles with that variety across business and tech, would you say?
So after I was laid off from that role last year, I spent the year doing some interim contract work whilst I found the right role that I was looking for. And so did a couple of different pieces. One was in kind of setting up a technology portfolio space and sort of bridging that gap between stakeholders and the tech team who weren't really talking to each other. And that again was in a scale-up type business. And then the other role was heading up a business systems team, which covered systems and an industry I didn't have any experience in. So, yes, they had that variety, but they were both probably more tech focused, whereas the business operations role was a real mixture of people, process, company reporting, and a bit of tech. So, I would do something similar to that again. And then now I'm at Gymshark. I am responsible for the leadership of retail and operations business systems. And the strategic thinking that goes behind those. So, yeah, it's really exciting because obviously it's growing at a huge rate. And as you'll see from my LinkedIn, I'm also hiring. So, and I suspect my team will continue to grow.
Okay, any listeners that are listening that's looking for a new job, I think there's a couple of assistant administrator jobs that Charlotte's looking for, so reach out to her if you're looking for a new role. Let's just stay on Gymshark for the moment because
Sure.
it's been a great success journey that they've been on, right? And I'm sure, and you're still relatively new there, so
Yeah, I've only been there a couple of months.
yeah, so it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts of, I suppose, the process that you've been involved with so far, joining them as an organisation, and because they have gone through a massive growth spurt, if you ask me. So, what does that look like internally?
I'm not sure how I can even describe this because I'm still so new in the role and the company, but the culture is and then this is going to sound a bit cringy, but it's like they, I don't know what they, how they've done it, but they've got like some sort of secret sauce, because from day one, they have made you feel like you've always been there, you know, and they're very inclusive and they're very clear about what their strategy is, and they even show you when you join how product is made, and you know, they expose you to lots of different parts of the business, and you know, considering they're going through such a growth period, they're very much, and they'll be, anybody from Gymshark will be surprised to hear me say this, but I think having worked for other scale up businesses and other kind of more established businesses in the retail space, they're very mature in some ways in their processes. And then in others, like, you know, they started off as an e-commerce business and now they're going into retail. So obviously we opened Regent Street last year, and as part of the ongoing success of that, my team is involved in enabling the retail expansion. And so obviously I can't talk about that too much, but you know, it's a hugely exciting time to be there. But I would just say, like, for me, it's by far and away, when I look at all the businesses I've worked at, they have the best culture I've ever come across. They're so people focused. And that for me is a big surprise, given, you know, how much growth they've got to go through, like how quickly they've grown. Because it's just, you know, that typically doesn't happen so much when you're in a scaling business, is being so people focused.
We interrupt this podcast to mention our sponsors, tech talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. If you're looking for work or looking for your next hire, please head to their website and register your interest at russellkingassociates.com. Right, back to the show. Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one when you talk about the culture, not just at Gymshark, but anywhere you go, because I think we're in a society now where all businesses are on, like, LinkedIn or Glassdoor, they can be viewed anywhere. So I think you can kind of get an understanding of culture, but you'll never really know until you're through the door and working there, right? So, and I've heard the culture there is fantastic. It's great to hear that's the case. But it's not, you don't need to name names, but what is the difference between a Gymshark culture and maybe some of the other cultures out there? It doesn't need to be some of the ones that you previously worked for, but you know, you say there's a secret sauce, but most organisations want that secret sauce. You know, what is the difference? What do they do? I know you said that they are inclusive and, you know, you get exposure to different parts of the business. They show you how the products are made, which is great. Is it that? Is it because they literally, you know, it's no holds barred of showing you everything behind the scenes that makes the culture what it is? Or is there something different there, do you think?
I think everybody is it going in the same direction. And that's the key thing. You know, you work in lots of businesses and some people are going in that direction, but other people are like, oh, I'm not so sure. Everybody I've spoken to, what everything I've seen, heard, directionally, everybody is aligned to the way we're going, the way we're moving. And I think having everybody feeling that accountability and wanting to do that, and that's the thing, people want to do that and they are so passionate about it, and it's just, it's honestly, it's incredible. I've never really experienced anything quite like it. Maybe in the early days of Metapack, for sure, I definitely saw that, but not to the same extent. And the thing I've always been looking for when I look for a new role is a feeling, and I know that's super not a tech thing to say, not data driven at all, which is very unlike me, but even in the interview process, you know, I had that feeling, you know, from the people that I met, from the types of things that we discussed, the tasks that they asked me to perform, you know, it's, you can see that they are collaborative, inclusive. Everybody wants to work together. Everyone's pulling in the same direction. That's really hard to achieve and keep people motivated to be that way. And, you know, it's a very motivating place to work.
Yeah, it sounds like a fantastic place to work.
I feel very lucky to have joined, I have to say.
It's great to hear, obviously, the journey you've been on from the interview process to where you are now. And I think you said this earlier on at the beginning of the show about, it's about the people as well. So I know you said obviously Gymshark's been great, but some of the other interviews you've been on in the past, mm-hmm. have you had that gut feeling of like, no, definitely don't want to work here then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. And I think, unfortunately, you do get it a lot when you're looking at startup scale-up businesses. You know, there was another, be careful I say this, there's another company that I was interviewing with at the same time as Gymshark, mm-hmm. and similar size business, also consumer-facing business, so I won't be naming names. And they were still founder-led. And I think one of the red flags that I've seen as I've worked in more and more startup scale-up businesses and interviewed more in that space is the founder red flag. And, you know, and some of the behaviour that goes with that. So, yes, this other company, one of the questions I'd asked alludes to the fact that this particular founder could... You know, there was a strategy, and then they would go in and just go, actually, no, I want to do this, mm-hmm. and just wipe everything out, which is not scalable. It's not how you scale a business. And sometimes you get those founders that have got funny quirks about them, and there's a reason that they're a founder and they're entrepreneurial and not a professional CEO.
Yeah.
And so those are definitely things that I look out for during an interview process. You don't have to think about those things so much when you're applying for a corporate role where you're going to work for a company that's run by a corporate CEO and a very experienced C-suite. I think the thing I always am on the lookout for is what the senior leadership team look like, or what the wider leadership team look like, and how they behave, and what their founder is like. And then, you know, I think... I remember being interviewed by another founder, and they turned around to me in an interview and said, so, my last question for you is, how many hours are there in a day? Like, you know, and asking questions like that, trying to trip people up. Mm-hmm. And I think that you have to be a certain type of person to want to work in that environment, and that's not for me. I go to do an excellent job. I go to go solve problems. I'm not going to, you know, for me, that's very lad culture. And it's not for me. And then the other one that always, and I mentioned this on the podcast I do with Lucy, is that I got asked once, are you an Imperial War Commander or a pirate? And explain why.
Oh, God.
And again, it's from that startup scale-up world. And yes, for me, I have to weed those people out because I'm not interested in working in a place that's got those types of things as an interview question.
Yeah.
Because it just tells me a lot about the culture.
It does. I agree with you. I agree. And look, you've managed teams. You said, you've interviewed people. So
many times.
So what do you look for in an interview? How do people get your attention? How do you know, what is it that you look for? Because let's say, for example, you've got a job role you're interviewing for, you've got five candidates you're going to interview, you've got one job. So all five are going to come across fairly credible. They've got some experience. How do they impress you in the interview? What have they got to do?
I mean, look, it depends on the seniority of the role. So, you know, I'm not going to be looking necessarily for the same things from an entry-level role as I would do if I was interviewing a director or a head of, for example. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, I'm usually looking for somebody that's got a combination of really amazing skill set, transferable skills if they've not done that role before, enthusiasm, passion, and kind of a bit of tenacity, mm-hmm. and drive.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I can't stress enough that I vary the kind of weighting around those things depending on whether it's entry level role versus a senior role. And just, you know, that for me, the worst thing I always think is when you interview somebody and they don't have a clue about the business that you're working in. And I think that's indefensible when it's a consumer facing business.
Mm-hmm.
But you also see it a lot when I've worked in, you know, supplier based businesses and you know, people turn up and they don't really know anything.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, in a market like we are in now, where there are so many people looking for work, you know, you have to be able to stand out in the crowd. The other thing that I really like, personally, and this might be controversial, but I like a cover letter.
Do you?
Because I've hired people previously on the strength of their cover letter rather than their CV. Because their CV didn't tell me why they were interested in the role, what they can bring, what, all these extra things. And I know there's a whole school of thought about, oh, you don't need to see a cover letter. And even though at Gymshark, we don't necessarily ask for a cover letter, there is like a section in the application. It's like, why Gymshark? And and I read some of the answers people write, the passion and the enthusiasm, and the, it really, you get a real sense of that person. But I think also, I remember somebody saying to me when I was interviewing, she said, I'm so glad to read such an interesting cover letter that wasn't generated by AI.
True.
So,
Very true.
so
I think that the cover letter one's
yeah.
an interesting subject because I represent organizations across a wide variety of different sectors, right? And some actually ask for a cover letter or a summary of their skill sets,
Yeah.
and some don't. And actually, some of those organizations that do ask for that cover letter or a summary, the hiring managers will use that information. And then I've got one particular client where it's only used by HR, not the hiring manager. It's done for a HR tick box exercise, which I find very strange because
Yeah.
you're making the candidate spend time completing a cover letter, and the hiring manager doesn't even read it.
That's odd.
Yeah, I find it odd. I think it is. I mean, do you think at the different levels of experience that you're recruiting for that a cover letter is essential? Like when you get to the more senior levels, that's still needed, or do you think it's more the junior to mid-level type roles that it's a bit more essential for?
Well, I mean, look, I write them, and I think it adds, it's a value add. So your CV is your value proposition, and your cover letter gives that next level of detail. But I also refuse to customize my CV by role, because I'm a generalist. I would just constantly be customizing my CV for every single role, and who's got time for that? Whereas if you write a cover letter, that's the customization that you offer. And if they're not asking for one, I quite often will just insert one at the top of the CV attachment because I just think it tells them a bit more about your personality, who you are, what specifically in your CV you can offer them.
I'm just thinking, when someone's looking for work at the moment and they are applying for jobs left, right, and centre, right? They're out of work. It's a
Yep,
really
been there.
tough market. Yeah, it's a tough market. Are they going to have time to customize a cover letter for every application? It's going to be quite a time-consuming process, no? Or have you got to pick and
Well,
choose the right ones to write it for, maybe?
I think you have to be, so I was laid off at the back end of 2022, and then last year I did some short-term contracts whilst I was looking for something that I wanted. And I said to you earlier, I had a post-it note of five non-negotiables. So I was being very intentional about what I was applying for. If you're not being intentional, I can totally understand if you're like scattergun applying for everything because you need a job. And I get that not everyone has the luxury to be able to take the time and be intentional because, for example, my former colleagues at Matches Fashion, that went into administration. They wouldn't have had any redundancy pay from that. That's a different kettle of fish altogether. But I think if you've been laid off, particularly, and you have got that buffer, that financial buffer, then, be intentional about what you apply for and then write a cover letter with that because I think otherwise, if you're doing the scattergun approach, I think you're right, there's probably too much to do. But I do think it sets a candidate apart. And as I said, I have hired somebody based on the strength of their cover letter. Well, I mean, I invited them to interview based on the strength of their cover letter and then went on to hire them later on. But I would never have seen them if I'd have just read their CV.
Yeah, okay. All right, really good point. I think this kind of goes nicely into the podcast you co-host, which is Careers and Coffee, with Lucy, who was on recently on the podcast. Talk to me about that. Why did you set it up? What's involved? It'd be interesting to hear.
Sure. So Lucy and I actually, we both used to work at Selfridges together in the IT department, because that's what they called it. And actually, we never knew each other. So we worked in this massive IT department, never met each other. And we, on our tenure, crossed over. And then I re-met her, if you like. So I kind of knew of her, and she knew of me, but we didn't really know each other. And then we met through a community that we were both in around women in tech. And we obviously hit it off, and we were chatting about, we always chat. We usually have a kind of weekly coffee chat and put the world to rights, as you do. And, you know, we were like, we were talking one day, and we were just like, why don't we turn this into a podcast? Because it's not just us that think these things, you know. And I was laid off at the time. I think Lucy also, she was in between different roles, and we just thought now is a good opportunity. And we wanted to do something a bit different, because a lot of things that have been associated with us in the past have been purely about women in tech, and we wanted to do something for everyone. And I talk about being a creative career conversationalist, because I'm very passionate about careers. I mentor in the background. I also go and talk at schools. One of the voluntary programs I do that through is Inspiring the Future, about careers. And, you know, because I don't know about you, but I certainly didn't get that when I was at school, anybody coming in and talking about careers and different things that you could go off and do, and, you know, inspiring people,
yeah.
Young people, which is really important, because not everyone's going to be an influencer as a career, or on Love Island. So anyway, so we were chatting, and at that point of time, you know, I was going through, like, I'd been through redundancy. She had her own podcast prior to that, and I'd spoken at length about redundancy on that podcast. And so we did an episode on Careers and Coffee about that as well, just to bring it up to date. And then we thought, well, actually, let's talk about the job journey, because we talked about, you know, I mentioned to her about, oh, I was asked this in an interview, and she said, oh, you know, such and such, didn't know how to use LinkedIn for that. So we kind of tried to build a guide of that journey in the first series, of like from redundancy right the way through to, you know, interview, networking, application, all of that good stuff. Mm-hmm. We wrapped that up, and then we did kind of like a Christmas special where we came back and reflected on our year, etc. And then we decided, we had a sort of chat, and we're like, what would series two look like? And I said to her, why don't we have guests? And so we then invited people from within our network, but we wanted to do something different, which wasn't just, you know, interviewing. It was talking about a specific theme. So we talked about different skills, experiences, expertise, anything from leadership to relocating to a different country for work, moving away from a corporate career. You know, a real broad spectrum, and that's kind of where we got to. And we did a little mini series that we didn't live record on LinkedIn, and that's on YouTube, which is about kind of mentoring, coaching, and sponsorship, as well as like a little aid to people to understand those a bit better. But yeah, so that's kind of we wrapped series two, oh god, at the end of February or beginning of March. So we're obviously on a pause at the moment, and but you know, I don't know what the future holds on that, but yeah, it's been great, and we've learned a lot, and hopefully it's given back to people a bit around careers. And we tried to make it useful with lots of resources and introducing you know, people who are not always the same people that are on podcasts or panels or, you know, public speakers. We wanted people that a bit like how you've done with, you know, people who, you know, have a job and have something interesting to say, you know, because I think the power of that is just as important as having some sort of, you know, celebrity LinkedIn influencer type.
100% real life people going for real life. Yeah, 100%. It was really nice hearing the variety of the topics you covered in that. And actually, I haven't seen one yet, so I will go back and actually have a little watch on YouTube. And I know you mentioned YouTube. Is it on any other platforms for any of our listeners if they want to have a...
So we did it all on LinkedIn as a LinkedIn Live. We didn't go down the audio-only route, but we may well put it onto Spotify and Apple at some point. But it is, if you want to catch up on all of it, it's on YouTube, and Careers and Coffee is the name of the channel.
Good, good. I look forward to catching up with it. And do you think there will be a season three?
I couldn't comment. I think we're on a pause. We've got some ideas about what season three might look like, but we've both got a lot on at the moment, so I don't know. Watch this space.
Watch this space. Okay, all right. And in technology, so from when you first started out to where it is today, to where it's potentially going to go, because it has been, I'm thinking when I first got into work 25 years ago, I was kind of teetering on still faxing some CVs to clients to just about sending emails to clients with CVs attached. To where we are today and different platforms and stuff like that. Like, where do you see technology going? The evolution of it? Is it going to differ much from where we are today in the next kind of like 10, 15, 20 years? What are your views?
I think it's really interesting, and I think about retail and technology a lot, given what I do. And I think, interestingly, myself and one of my team are going to the retail technology show next week. But I suspect from some of the vendors and suppliers and partners that we've met with and talked to, that we're going to see much more in the AI space. I think, if I'm just super specific around retail stores, at the moment, we have the chip and PIN machines, the PEDs that do all the payment. I suspect there will be changes in that space as well that will make it even less requirement to have a piece of hardware to do that. What that looks like, I don't know, but I think there'll be definitely something in that space that will change. And then, as I say, I think building on AI and even machine learning as well, I suspect that will really start to change the shape of retail technology, and continue to grow in an exciting direction.
Sounds very exciting. Now, when you say the hardware piece, do you mean the hardware piece from the chip and pin perspective? From
Yeah, in the actual machine, they call them PEDs. So, in a kind of more traditional store, they're like a big clunky thing, or they're like mounted. But then you'll also see those small, the sort of small square ones as well,
Yeah, I've seen
which I
those.
think square is one of those. But I suspect that they might come up with some sort of technology that means that you no longer need that type of machine to be able to take the payment. What that looks like, I don't know.
That's interesting. And then do you still think the consumer will still be very much phone-based payment or anything
I think
different?
that will grow. Well, I think that will grow because I think that, when I take people like in my parents' generation, I mean, they're like, "What are you doing? How are you paying with your phone?" As with everything, they will catch up, and I think that that will continue to grow. But I also think that, companies like Klarna and Clearpay, that will continue to grow as well as a payment method. And then when you look at China, for example, WeChat Pay is huge. And is there anything else that's going to come out from that side of the world as well will also be interesting.
Okay, exciting times ahead potentially.
Yes. And of course, any automation that helps us being more efficient within operations and the back of house, I think is also important to drive efficiency, and what that will mean for the change of the roles that exist there, I think will also be interesting.
Can we just stay on that subject for a minute then? So when you say back of house and
Sure.
the changing of roles, how do you see that evolution happening then?
Well, so we already, I mean, I'm trying to think how long back now, even thinking about 15 years ago, there's already been automation put into warehouses. Like, you have things like auto lidders that are machines that put a box, a lid on a box, and sorting machines. So you're taking away the need for that to be done manually. And the rise of things like RFID and higher quality labels that are being printed through the likes of Zebra and others. I should say. But and then, back of house is how they manage the stock that gets back out onto the floor, the replenishment that all sits behind that. Across lots of retailers, they all do it slightly differently, and they're always looking to drive efficiency. And I think some of those things is where you see human error, where things are mispicked or they're sold as a different SKU, which is a stock keeping unit for anybody that doesn't work in retail, which means that then it looks like that store has sold something that they don't even have as a piece of stock. So, there's lots of things that we can do behind the scenes that then enable this spectacular experience for a customer that doesn't even consider there's anything going on, behind the back of the store.
Look, I want to kind of finish on women in tech.
Sure.
Because I think it's a title which has been out for a little while now, and you're a mentor in for Read Women in Tech
Yeah, and others.
and others as well. And obviously, I know you mentioned about talking at schools, and I've had this conversation previously with other guests on the show around we need to do more in schools to entice young women into technologies and. Rather than just thinking it's a coding type role, what do you think we need to do differently in society to make technology a career path which women want to look to do, rather than let's say a lot of them looking at influencer type roles or these new or YouTuber type role or whatever it is, how can we attract women more into technology?
Role modeling, I think, is number one, is seeing more female role models who are doing this and having more access to them, I think is really important. So, I try to do take my part in that by going and speaking at schools and by making myself available as a mentor, and talking about it constantly. And I think, we have to educate all sort of young people from a much earlier age. And I think we need to, I think part of it is the bias that exists in education, which guides, young boys, men down kind of a more of a STEM path, and girls, women, towards, I don't know, HR marketing. Those are the typically biased, gender roles that you're supposed to do as a woman, I guess. I think, we also, as a woman in tech, I talk about role modeling. We need to make it more welcoming, and we need to support women. And, if you look at, if you took a cross section of all my posts on LinkedIn, most of them will have the hashtag women supporting women. Because when I came into technology, I was often the only woman in the room, and then the women that were there were not nice because they were protecting their space. Because there's only room for one woman at the table, and we need to make it inclusive and welcoming for everyone, and inviting, and thinking, oh, actually, maybe there will be other women here, and maybe I can learn something from them, and rather than what happens on the contrary. And again, I wrote an article about this not so long ago, which is about Queen Bee syndrome, where you're like keeping that one person that's the senior person, and they push away the more junior. So I think I come back to role modeling across all aspects of what I have said. That I think is the number one thing we can do as a woman in tech. But then in terms of allies from a male perspective, it's about encouraging, your daughters, your nieces, and any other young female that you can help shape their path in. It's talking positively about having women in tech and being allies and encouraging and saying, oh, do you know a friend of mine, she does this, and really kind of reinforcing that. So yes, but I get off my soapbox because I could talk about this for hours.
No, it's good. I like it. Just going back on the role modeling and having access to them.
Sure.
Obviously, it's great having individuals like yourself who will go into a school. What else though? Because that's probably not enough. Getting one speaker come in or a couple of
No,
speakers coming
sure.
on. What else can we do to kind of change that? Should we? Social media is such a big platform now. I never had it as a child growing up, and I think,
Me neither.
yeah,
Didn't exist, did it?
and obviously most of society today children of that age are on social media. So should we have influencers influencing them to go into technology? You know, should that be a, you know, a way forward? Or have you got any other ideas? It'd be interesting to hear.
I mean, I haven't really thought about the social media lens. As somebody that doesn't have children herself, I don't really think about children and social media that much, because in my mind, because I, as I said, I'm that old that social media didn't exist. Like, I hadn't necessarily thought about that as a way to attract, you know, young girls into technology. What I have seen is there's a community called the Girls Network, mm-hmm. which is present on social media, and is a charity and connects professional women with young women, particularly in sort of more working class backgrounds, deprived areas, to help to entice them into technology roles. I also think businesses have a part to play in, you know, also going along, talking to schools, hosting events. You know, I don't know about you, but like when I was at school, you had to do like a week of work experience. My week of work experience was in a shop. You know, I don't remember anybody in my year or my school going off and doing something in a technology business. Maybe that does exist. Again, I don't have children, so I can't comment, but you know, making those more available and attracting more young talent into the business in general is a good thing.
Yeah. Like you, I did my work experience in a shop. So did I learn much? Probably not. For that week, you know, did it really help me for the rest of my career? No, it didn't. Has my son, who was at school, had a slightly different experience? He has, because he actually did work experience for HSBC, and he got to see different areas of the business. So I think that was a little bit more interesting for him. So I think, but I don't think everyone gets those opportunities. He was very lucky to get that. And I think, like you said, more businesses need to help attract or show the different opportunities that people can have. So we need the likes of HSBC and other organisations like that to be a little bit more open to allowing students to come and see the different types of areas of a business. It doesn't just have to be technology. Technology is obviously one piece. And I think people, when you say IT to a young girl maybe, I think that scares them. I think technology needs to come across. It's not all about, I think they just worry that it's going to be getting into a laptop or a machine and that's what technology is about. I think there's so much more to technology. You've got projects, you've got service management, you've got so much more that it's not just about, you know, a coding or stripping a laptop apart or anything like that. Does that make sense?
No. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think I started this by saying my parents were shocked when I went into IT, in air quotes, because it wasn't a subject at school I particularly enjoyed.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, there's something that you said there, which is, you know, your son had different opportunities. And then I was thinking about, you know, not everybody goes to university. So, you know, a university or a college, you know, there are other opportunities to kind of get exposed to more of these businesses. We need to start earlier and younger. And maybe it's actually that we have types of technology kind of classes earlier at school, in primary school, that are not just focused on how to use a computer, but you know, I think that's a broader conversation in general, because I also think we should be teaching children how to do financial planning and understanding how to apply for a mortgage and, you know, all of those useful life skills. So
I completely agree
without
with you.
Diverting onto that too much, I do think that the younger that we start talking about this to them, it becomes just more normal and more inclusive. And I think lots of businesses and lots of people don't talk about IT anymore because it's quite old fashioned. And, you know, we need to be talking about tech and digital and e-commerce and, you know, things that actually young people understand.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I completely agree with you in regards to the school system. I think we need to be teaching more life-based experience stuff, which they're going to use. I mean, if I look back at what I learned and what was being taught to me, have I really utilized most of that stuff in where I am today? Probably not. So I think it does need, but that's a different conversation. I could talk about it. Yeah, very much so. Look, I could go on talking forever. I'm sure you could as well, but we do need to wrap it up. Is there anything else you want to cover off before we finish it for the session?
No, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
No, thank you very much. It's been great having you on Tech Life Stories. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast, Tech Life Stories, sponsored by tech talent staffing firm Russell King Associates. If you like what you hear, please leave a review on the podcast platform you are listening from. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can find me posting daily on LinkedIn, so look me up and connect. Remember, it's not what people think of you when you first start, it's what people think of you when you finish.